I'd like all the speakers to come up to the podium, and we'll have a question and answer period.
Please.
Yeah, I have a question for Dr. Misra. Sometimes UF control fails our patients. Like patients come to dialysis, and you intend to remove 2 kilo, and 2.5 kilo comes off. They develop severe cramps. Is there any reason for it?
So the question is that you remove more than what you intend.
What is intended, right? Or what is set up on the machine?
What is exactly? Couldn't hear that again. What is what?
The UF control. Like you set up for 2 liter fluid removal, and 2.5 liter comes up, and patient comes up with a severe cramping.
Right. So the question is, the patient needed 2 kilos off, ended up getting 2.5 off, and what happened? Obviously, again, it comes down to the fact that the way the volumetric machines work, the computer tracking the ultrafiltration pump constantly tracks what has been programmed in and how much it should be removed, and actually titrates the ultrafiltration as the process goes on. So in your particular example, I do not know what happened, but I think because it's if you come to think about it, it's a very fail-safe mechanism. You have a patient with 2 liters UF required. You have a certain amount of time fed into the machine, and the rest is up to the machine to decide how quickly it does it. And most of the times, if it happens, it's due to a problem with the ultrafiltration device or the processor monitor rather than anything else.
Dr. Handelman, please.
Yeah, I have a question for Dr. Ritz. I think it's pretty well established that patients with congestive heart failure are anemic, and the anemia appears to be linked to inflammation and impaired utilization of stored iron and erythropoiesis. Would it be possible to design an experiment that would show definitively, as George likes to speak in terms of equipoise, one way or the other, whether the impaired intestinal perfusion that is accompanied with poor cardiac output is responsible for the inflammation and anemia that's seen in congestive heart failure? I realize it's a challenging question, but I think we need experiments that will settle that issue definitively so it ceases to be a speculation and becomes it's established whether it's true or not.
Well, it's certainly an alternative explanation to the current paradigm that if you have low output and cardiac failure, the first tissue perfusion to switch off or reduce is the intestine, which is the least organ immediately necessary for survival. But there may be more than one explanation, and your proposal is certainly reasonable. Yes?
Follow up the question, do you think the plasma volume expansion,
which we see in dialysis patients and in congestive heart failure, could be playing a role in altering bowel flora or pathology leading to linking these?
Frankly, there is no good explanation, no good research about intestinal colonization. We do not even know which bacteria are involved. We just know from culture studies, the number of bacteria increased. And we know also that only a minority of intestinal bacteria really grow in vitro, and that we grossly underestimate the flora existing in the gut. So I think this is wide open for research, and we do need better methods for identifying the colonic and extracolonic bacteria, and there are in the normal population great efforts to identify bacteria which do grow in vitro, and there has been claims that only 3% of the bacteria colonizing the colon can be identified by in vitro culture. So this is wide open for further studies.
I just wanted to add to that our laboratory doctors are really going to blow this thing wide open with a DNA fingerprinting of the blood. And there's some exciting techniques that are being developed that will be able to identify bacteria in the bloodstream long before a culture may or may not ever grow out. So just identifying foreign DNA in the body and then quickly going down a phylogenetic tree to get it to a relative strain and species, et cetera. So I think the idea is we probably have a entry of bacteria in our bloodstream probably all the time. You know, when a patient gets neutropenic with chemotherapy, they have a leakage, if you will, of gastrointestinal bacteria in the bloodstream. We can actually culture it out. In some cases, we probably have that all the time. And this idea of chronic inflammation, that's probably part of the explanation of why periodontal disease has been linked to various things as well.
Dr. Martino, thanks for coming. I'm not sure you helped yourself when you asked people to raise their hands if they've been MI trained, but it was a nice try to feel less of an odd bird, I guess, huh? So, you know, my question for you is how do you recognize what are appropriate targets for the use of MI in chronic care and chronic illness? Because as you outlined, you know, usually it's when there's a clear recognition of what the community would believe is a good health behavior. And, you know, on the day-to-day basis, sometimes it's hard to sort that out, particularly given that our guidelines are based on grades B or C evidence.
I don't think I have a precise answer for your question, but I think in motivational interviewing, we struggle with the issue of appropriate targets relative to those that we would take more of a stance of equipoise. So when there seems to be no clear indication of what is in a patient's best interest and the choice is fully theirs, and we don't have evidence to guide us as to which is more effective, let's say, we take a neutral stance and sort through their dilemmas and help them come to their own conclusions. But when there is some, you know, direction that seems to have some support for what would improve their quality of life, their health, we do take a stance. Motivational interviewing is directive, actually, even though it has as its glue a patient-centered approach. So it's this sort of curious, ironic blend of these two qualities that really make the approach what it is. From what I've learned, and I'm a novice to what you all do, most of the things that concern you are things that concern most healthcare professionals when it comes to chronic disease management. Diet and exercise, I don't find that there would be much argument about what would be in a person's best interest. Medications, it depends, and so on. We could go down the list. But that's generally the thought process that underlies the decision of what's appropriate to target and not.
Question for Dr. Ritz. Could you comment perhaps on the relationship between the trans-bowel migration of bacterial products that you think contributes to the cardiovascular disease in perineal dialysis patients? Because these same products must migrate into the perineal space. And could that contribute to some of the long-term difficulties in patients on PD?
Absolutely. There are no studies on this, but it's very logical and follows from what we know from the literature on hemodialysis. I'm not certain whether McIntyre has a study on peritoneal dialysis, but nothing has been published so far. But it's quite quite logical step to look into this.
Yes, Victor Gura, Los Angeles, question for Dr. Ritz. There is, in fact, a lovely paper by Anker and Jack in which he shows that in CHF you have a marked widening of the intestinal mucosa, suggestion that there is edema and breaching of the permeability. So the mechanistic explanation might be that simply the edema, as central venous pressure raises, breaches the barrier between the gut and the blood and allows the penetration of toxins. But what's tantalizing is that the same paper shows that the flora in CHF patients is completely different, and they have quite significant data on that. And I don't have a very good understanding on why is that. You described anoxia as a potential further mechanism for the alterations inside the gut, and maybe there is a combination. And furthermore is, if we correct the edema, and reduce again the size or the thickness of the mucosa, would we be able to reverse this? Great questions.
I didn't quite get it. In which situation did one not see an increase in the width of the mucosa?
I did not. Anker did, and what it shows is that there is an increase in the width of the mucosa. Has beautiful pictures of that.
It's basically venous congestion of the intestines as well.
I had difficulty to understand the question. I can't answer without... Perhaps you can...
I think you're picking up on an important point that none of us really emphasized, but it's this new understanding. It's actually several studies now show this, that if you were to do a hemodynamic profile of heart failure patients that ultimately go into acute kidney injury once they go in the hospital, that venous congestion is a leading hemodynamic determinant, if you will. And, you know, because the large veins are a valveless system, that venous pressure that the kidneys are seeing must be the same venous pressure that the intestines are seeing, and that maybe that plays a role. And all of us have seen this clinically when you order a CT scan on a patient for a variety of reasons, and you'll see about gut edema, and it does make me wonder about the contribution of venous congestion to this whole picture, and you could almost call it a cardiorenal intestinal syndrome, if you will. I think that hemodynamic determinant really does need to be pursued. It's a lead.
Let me just quickly extend this discussion a little bit. Can you hear me? This whole field of organ edema has been getting so much attention in that organ crosstalk seems to happen within minutes of one organ getting disarrayed. So you clamp the renal artery and you can see downstream effects in terms of molecular and ionic changes as far downstream as brain and gut and heart. And so all that is very relevant, but not much we know about it.
I have a question for Dr. Misra. Is there ever a direct contact of the patient's blood with the dialysis machine itself, besides the disposable tubing and filter? And if the answer is no, what is the rationale of not using the same machine in patients who have hepatitis C infection and regular patients?
Well, the rationale is that the disposability that can happen, the dialyzer fibers may rupture, the blood may leak, and especially the if you look at the patients who are infected with hepatitis and HIV, you have to make sure that you have to follow proper disinfection protocols. But by and large, you're right that there's no direct contact, but when you're thinking about the blood circuit and the blood going through the dialyzer, and then if for some reason the dialyzer ruptures or the fibers rupture and the blood leak occurs and appears in the dialysate, at some point, you can have a breach of the system, and that can cause problems.
One question for Dr. McCullough. Do you know any study on the vascular calcification on post-transplantation who usually have a normal or low phosphorus level?
Yeah, so the question is, you know, after transplant, the phosphorus levels come down. What happens to the natural history of coronary calcification? I'm not aware of that observation being carried forward in transplant patients, but I did publish a meta-analysis towards the late of 2009 where we looked at every single intervention out there that was tested in a randomized trial and ask the question, can we significantly change the rate of calcification as measured in human coronary arteries? And the answer is no. So even lowering LDL cholesterol, lowering blood pressure, different types of phosphate binders you can use, none of them seem to change the rate of calcification. Now, there's never been a trial of phosphate lowering versus not lowering it. It's always one phosphate binder versus another where the phosphorus levels are the same in both groups. But there's never been anything that actually influences the natural history of the calcification. And these calcification scores that we measure in the coronary arteries increase by about 20% per year. It is slightly higher for renal patients than for normal patients, but not that much different. What changes after transplantation, and there's a great paper in JCC on this, what really changes after transplantation is left ventricular remodeling. The left ventricle, the left ventricular volumes reduce, left ventricular ejection fraction goes up, left ventricular mass index goes down. All the favorable changes occur, we think, probably just due to better minute-by-minute handling of sodium and water and probably neurohormonal changes.
May I just briefly comment on this? Presumably, we come too late once you have coronary calcification. The real challenge is to prevent the first nucleus. Once you have calcium in the coronary, it will continue to grow. This is very elegant to show in animal studies.
That's true. One brief question. Yeah. Got a last question. To Dr. Ritz, do you think on the one hand, if you're wildly fluid overloaded, you have a lot of bowel wall edema, so you have entry of toxins. On the other hand, if you try and keep patients too dry, you may have ischemic insult to the intestine and also perhaps increase the increase of endotoxin into the blood. Do you think that it might be a U-shaped sort of relationship in terms of fluid balance and entry of intestinal toxins?
Absolutely. I think if you are hypovolemic, there is a great chance that you have vasoconstriction in the upstream arterioles and ischemia of the mucosa. And we have ischemia of the mucosa, at least in cardiac models, at the very tip of the villi because of the countercurrent system. So both hypo and hypervolemia, as you suggest, may be deleterious, and there is some indirect evidence for both explanations.
Thank you all, and please make certain to fill out your evaluations.